on air, online, on digital, and the ABC Listen app.
This is the Country Hour with Callie Buchanan on ABC Radio Queensland.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the program. I hope you're managing to stay cool today because it is hot, 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 and it has been for a pretty long stretch. In fact, Queensland is close to breaking a record. Here's Phelim Hanafy from the Bureau late last week.
It could be a November record for parts of the northwest, particularly if we see 10 consecutive days of 40 degrees or more. That would pip, I think it was 2015 was the previous record, which was 10, so we could go above that.
Yes, the northwest is on track to break its record for the number of consecutive days above 40 degrees in November. If you take a look at the run of temperatures from Mount Isa, November 1st, 39.3 degrees. But since then, every day has been over 40. 40 is predicted again today and the low 40s for tomorrow. So today would make day 10. Tomorrow is day 11. If you've got your own records, I'd love you to share them with me. 0487 993 222. Is an above average hot start to November unusual in your part of the state? Let me know. Has the heat been a bit different for you this time? 0487 993 222 is the number to send me a message. Because, of course, the people in the northwest and northern interior will tell you they're pretty used to a run of scorches, even if they have come earlier in the year. But it's one thing for people to manage a heat wave. How well do livestock fare in these conditions, though? Well, if you're wanting to know just how comfortable your cattle are, it's a bit hard to ask them. You could, though, check the Cattle Comfort Index forecast. Now, one of the brains behind this tool is Timothy Cowan. He's a senior research fellow at the University of Southern Queensland, and as part of the Northern Australia Climate Program, has this tool for you to use. He joins me now. Good afternoon, Tim.
G'day, Callie.
Well, for those not particularly familiar or maybe needing a bit of a reminder, how exactly does the Cattle Comfort Index forecast work?
Yeah, sure. So we take predictions from one of the Bureau's numerical weather prediction models, which has predictions of temperature, relative humidity, solar radiance, so solar input, and also wind speeds. And we run this through an algorithm and it produces a cattle comfort index. So it's essentially like a feel-like temperature for cattle.
Do cows feel like the weather different to the way humans feel like the weather?
Yeah, well, cattle, obviously, they pant when they get hot. So the hotter it is and the more they have to try and deal with that heat, and they will start to pant more, and they'll get to a stage where they just can't cope anymore. And if they don't seek shade or seek out a water point, then they can run into some serious impacts.
There's also an evaporative stress index factor. Can you explain that to me?
Yeah, so this is more related to drought and I guess the rapid sort of declining into drought. So it relates to whether there's wet conditions or whether there's like a rapid drying. So if there's lots of water around on the surface after a heavy rainfall event, and then you get some sun coming out, then you might actually have the potential to evaporate more, but the actual evaporation might be quite low. But as you head into dry conditions, then the actual evaporation can actually drop a bit because you don't have a moisture in the soil to evaporate. So we can look at this evaporative stress index to try and gauge whether we're heading into, say, a flash drought. So this is like a rapid movement into a drought, which can catch producers off guard.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's one thing to have these tools at your fingertips, but what do they tell us about things like a run of hot days that we're seeing in the northwest and northern interior at the moment, and what action people can actually take?
Yeah, sure. So there is another index called the heat load index, which over time you can measure the accumulation of heat in cattle. So it gives you a sense of what's happened in the past week or even the past 2 weeks. And then you can look at the forecast going forward to see, well, how is this building on what I've already seen? So say you're running Brahman in the northwest, and you know that you've had a run of really hot days, and then you look at, say, a forecast of the accumulated heat load in your cattle, it might show that for the next week or so, then it's slowly building and it's going from a, say, a moderate to a high to an extreme level. So that gives you some idea about maybe there are some decisions you can make around moving those cattle to your shadier point, making sure they have access to water and to feed as well.
And I note that you published earlier this year, it's been nearly 15 years of the Cattle Comfort Index in particular in operation. What have we learned in that time over how cattle respond to some of these heat events?
Yeah, so we looked at historic events going back, as you say, 15 or 20 years or so. This is based on observation, so this is not forecast. But what we found is that you can see some events where we know there've been quite a large mortality in cattle, and you can look at the temperatures of an actual event, and you say, well, the temperatures weren't that extreme, so why are we seeing cattle? Why are we seeing cattle morbidity and cattle mortality? And it's when you factor in these other components like the relative humidity, the wind speed, so a drop in the wind speed, and maybe increased solar irradiance, then that can account for why you're seeing, say, higher field-like temperatures in cattle. And so, yeah, we've gone back over time and looked at a series of events, and it's really interesting to pull apart, well, what are some of those factors that contributed to the high temperatures? And it's not just one component. It's usually a multitude of components.
Sort of how we get a heat wave warning when it's not just hot days but also hot nights, and it's the cumulative impact of that not getting an opportunity to cool down that can be dangerous to people's health.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the same in cattle. So if they can't dissipate that heat overnight and that builds up over a number of days and nights, then really all it takes is just, say, one single extra day. And this is it's particularly the case for cattle in feedlots where they don't have the ability to move into a shaded region. So, yeah, you see these impacts. The longer the event goes on, the greater the chance of a morbidity event.
How quickly do those factors ease once we see a cool change?
Yeah, they can ease. I mean, often what you find is that if you get a change in the wind direction or just a change, maybe a rainfall event, but where the temperature drops enough, then obviously that can lead to an easing up of the conditions, and it lowers that risk. But for other places at the moment in the Northern Territory, where we've seen a heat wave pretty much over the past 1 or 2 weeks, you're seeing these conditions build up over time. So it'll take probably a break in the monsoon, say the onset of the monsoon, to really reduce those heat loads.
And so what is the Cattle Comfort Index forecast telling us at the moment, particularly for our producers in Queensland's interior?
Yeah, it's saying that it's going to be pretty warm out for the next few days. Our forecast shows every 3 hours. So the customer or the user can click through each of the maps and look at the conditions at each 3 hour interval. And it shows you that during the day, obviously the temperatures for the cattle company are going up well above 40. And then overnight it drops down, obviously, goes down to probably below 30, but you can see it each day it builds up again. So for the next few days, at least, it's going to be pretty extreme.
So a good time to familiarise yourself with some of those strategies to help reduce that cumulative heat load.
Absolutely, yep. So just make sure that the cattle have access to shade, access to water, and are kept happy.
Well, it's a fascinating tool and another one available to help people manage the heat and their animals. Thanks so much for your time on the Country Hour today.
Thanks, Kelly. Appreciate it.
Timothy Cowan is a Senior Research Fellow at the University of Southern Queensland's Centre for Applied Climate Sciences, working with the Northern Australia Climate Program. And if you're looking for any of those indexes, the Evaporative Stress Index or the Cattle Comfort Index, just search for Northern Australia's Climate Program. You'll find those online. You're listening to the Queensland Country Hour. It's 12:15. Now, coming up, one storm over the weekend delivered more than just rain.
from Dalby to Bell, there's been reports of frightening lightning, yes. I think there's photo evidence of like bursts of flames on the ground, and it must have been one of those that hit our stack.
Yes, yeah, some very, very frightening conditions, and particularly some warm and fire-prone weather on the agenda. I'll take you to that story very soon. In the meantime, share your observations with me, 0487 993 222. I'm particularly interested in your November temperatures coming up to maybe breaking a record in the northwest and northern interior. I'd love to know what your records are saying, 0487 993 222.
Nightlife.
G'day, Annabelle.
With Phil Clark.
I worked in the royal household in 1990, so I met Princess Diana.
Is that right?
I was a maid to the maids in Balmoral Castle.
What an experience. Wow.
I know, it was great.
What was she like?
She was beautiful, really kind, really fun. And I often felt we would get on if I wasn't the maid's maid and she wasn't the princess.
Nightlife.
What a great story.
Monday to Thursday with Philip Clark on ABC Radio.
On your radio, online, and on the ABC Listen app. This is the Country Hour with Kelly Buchanan on ABC Radio Queensland.
Now, you may be waiting for a storm to ease some of those temperatures, but sometimes they deliver more than just rain. Like on the Darling Downs, where over the weekend, one lightning strike set fire to a stack of barley straw at Bellfields, north of Dalby. Ian Stark says the frightening lightning completely destroyed the $30,000 worth of stack. He tells Lydia Burton about the storm.
At about 5 o'clock on Saturday afternoon, the storm rolled in from the south, so it came in over Dalby and straight up along the Bunya Highway, and out in front of it, it was throwing an extraordinary amount of lightning, and those lightning strikes were hitting the ground, and there's photo evidence of like bursts of flames on the ground, and it must have been one of those that hit our stack.
Oh my goodness. So it hit a stack of hay that you had?
It hit a stack of barley straw that was in our paddock. There was a number of stacks in the paddock. It just happened to be that this was the largest one, with probably in excess of 300 bales. Yeah, the barley straw was in the paddock waiting to be trucked to local feedlots. The contractor who does our hay has contracts to the local feedlots, and it was sitting there ready to be trucked. So that hay had already been sold.
Do you know what sort of financial loss you're talking then?
I haven't actually spoken to the contractor about how many bales were there, but I'm guessing there was in excess of 300 at $100 a bale, around about. So, yeah, $30,000 hit to the income from that venture.
It sounds pretty scary.
Well, apparently it was, yes, and that amount of lightning, I'm not sure where it started in that storm, but all the way through from Dalby to Bell, there's been reports of frightening lightning, yes. Some locals I've been talking to, it's certainly not unheard of. So it has happened before. Whether there's a heat or something in the stacks that attracts the lightning, I'm not sure. But it has happened before in that district.
And what happened with the fire? Did it stay sort of contained to the stack?
Yeah, thankfully, it must have been smouldering for a couple of hours before it got going. And it was around about 7 o'clock or between 7 and 8 o'clock before anyone noticed that the stack was on fire. And in the time between the lightning strike and when the fire got going, we had 21 mils of rain, which saved us. It wet the ground and wet the remaining barley stubble around the stack, so it didn't go anywhere. So it was sort of self-contained.
Thank goodness. The 21 mil of rain, though, did it make it difficult to get there, or did it put the fire out?
No, it certainly didn't put the fire out. I'm not sure there would be enough water in southeast Queensland to have put the fire out. It was a proper inferno.
Oh.
So no, it certainly didn't put the fire out. But what it did do is it stopped anyone attending the fire. The local fire brigade couldn't get in there on the black soil track. But I don't think that they'd have been able to stop the fire either. The only way to have stopped it would have been mechanically, I think, to knock a hole with a machine sort of between the burning stuff and the not burnt stuff, but that couldn't be done either because of the rain, and it might have been best that no one got in there because that sort of sounds pretty dangerous.
Yeah. The other side of that is 21 mil of rain. Is that good of any use to you?
Yes, it's quite dry at the moment at Dolby, so it's a long term. It's not an amount of rain that we can plant on, but some early planted crops. We've got 100 hectares of forage sorghum in. It certainly will help that, and people around there have already planted some of their grain sorghum, so it will help with the crops that are already planted.
So the cattle you have on that property, were they safe from this fire?
Well, because of the 21 mils of rain, they were. If a fire had have taken hold, it possibly would have run through their paddock. But, yeah, look, I think they would have been smart enough or had enough areas to have gotten away. But, yes, that would have been a worry. And it would have run straight past the homestead as well. But it's got established lawns and things too. I don't think it would have threatened there, but it could have been a lot worse.
Yeah. As you say, it's quite dry at the moment and the rain is exactly what's needed, but this sounds, you know, pretty full on, and those storms were looking pretty, you know, ominous. Just rain from now on, hey?
Yeah, rain is what we need. I think all that farming country over there, maybe not all in one fall, but certainly needs 100 to 150 mils to get a profile of moisture to certainly to make planting for grain viable.
That's Ian Stark from Bellfields north of Dolby speaking with Lydia Burton. And I have some details for you too of a Bushfire Watch and Act warning that was issued a short time ago by the Queensland Fire Department. It's for the area of Forsaith. Those in the area between Forsaith Airport and Stockman Creek Road, including Forsaith Township, Ainslie Road and Curral Station, need to prepare to leave. So right now there's a large, slow-moving fire and it's burning around Ainslie Road and travelling towards Forsaith. No properties are at risk, but conditions could get worse quickly and the fire is likely to impact the community tomorrow. So if you have a bushfire survival plan, you should follow it now. Just repeating, that's a Bushfire Watch and Act issued for Forsaith. If you're in that area between Forsaith Airport and Stockman Creek Road, including Forsaith Township, Ainslie Road and Curral Station, you need to prepare to leave. You can find out more details, including a map of the warning area on the ABC Emergency website and the ABC Far North Facebook page. Just search for ABC Far North on Facebook. And stay tuned to ABC Radio. We'll bring you further updates across the afternoon as that situation develops.
On your radio, online, and on the ABC Listen app, this is the Country Hour with Kelly Buchanan on ABC Radio Queensland.
Now, perhaps unsurprisingly, having heard that story from Dolby about the loss of all that barley, the Australian Fodder Industry Association says demand for hay is expected to increase as farmers across many parts of the country are battling challenging seasonal conditions. Some frost-affected farmers were expected to cut their crops for hay, which was anticipated to create large market supplies and keep prices steady. But chairperson of the Australian Fodder Industry Association, Lewis Kelly, says not many farmers actually ended up cutting for hay, deciding to harvest their damaged crop for grain instead.
The current demand's fairly strong. Traditionally, it would be the least amount of hay used at this time of the year because of the spring flush and everybody'd have plenty of grass, but at the moment, yeah, there are a lot of people still hand feeding and there's not a lot of hay being actually made at the moment.
How has the situation in the hay market shifted since the large frost event across parts in South Australia, Victoria and New South Wales earlier in September?
It hasn't shifted so much yet, but what has happened is that it was a very widespread frost event, and anybody who actually looked at where the frost and how the frost affected country, there was a big area of country affected from up as far as Parkes and Forbes right down into the Riverina through into the Wimmera and Mallee areas right through into South Australia over a series of different frosts. So anybody who watched it would say, yes, there's many millions of acres or hectares that are affected by frost. So you would assume that not everybody, but some people would have cut hay from those frost-affected crops. And if that did happen, there would have been a lot of area there, a lot of tons of hay produced. So therefore, as no floor price in hay, in the domestic price of hay in Australia, the price would have dropped because of the sheer quantity of material that was on the market. So people made the decision that they knew they could sell it as grain if they'd stripped it, even though they might have only got a 50% of what they might have been expecting. But that 50% would have been marketed into the world market through grain traders and such, whereas hay was left to the domestic market, that the price would have just kept falling, going down, when you consider how much would have been potentially on the market. The predictions that were made that, yes, potentially there could have been a lot of hay made after the frost event, have actually turned out to be, at the moment, don't look like to be coming true. So all the information you can get, there's still that humanism in there that people react to what's going to affect their bottom line. So how we seem to have finished up in this situation, I think, you've got to live by the decisions you make at the time a little bit and make those decisions with the information that you've got at your disposal.
With people not cutting for hay potentially, what did that mean for prices?
Prices were relatively firm at the time, and people could see that it was only going to go down if all this hay was cut. Well, the opposite has actually happened, where the demand has stayed strong through the hay harvest period, where it generally dips a little bit, and into the early summer and autumn, through the whole summer and autumn, potentially there's not going to be enough hay to go around, let alone what might be needed as supplement feed through next winter. So the price is going to go up. But in saying that, you've got to acknowledge the fact that a lot of hay delivered home now is already costing upwards of $400 a tonne, which that becomes, you need to do your figures, pretty tight figures on making that work in most situations. So people have got to make big calls now, as if, yes, potentially the price of hay could go up, potentially it could keep raining and we could keep a green drought going and get through without not using much hay. But there's a lot of variables in what we're looking at the moment.
Australian Fodder Industry Association Chairperson Lewis Kelly speaking to Jessica Schremer. What's the situation for you? 0487 993 222. Have you cut hay? Are you selling it or looking to buy it in some of these challenging seasonal conditions? I'd like to know what's happening at your place. 0487 993 222. It's almost 12:30. I'll have the Weather Bureau for you after that, including a heatwave warning that's just come out. I'll give you the details on that very soon. But one of the first things that the new LNP government did when it came into power in Queensland was press pause on the Pioneer Burdekin Pumped Hydro Power Project. And now communities around the other centrepiece in Queensland Hydro's grand plan, the Barumba Project, in the southeast of the state, have ramped up their plea for a redesign. Just before the election, five exploratory works packages worth $55 million all up were awarded to investigate things like road design and geotechnical works. But locals want the new state government to consider a completely alternative design for the whole project. Steve Burgess from the Mary River Catchment Coordinating Committee tells Jennifer Nichols a new design would mitigate the impact on the environment and downstream communities.
A major concern is that it's pumping a huge volume of water backwards and forwards every day from the top of the mountain down to Lake Brumba, which is actually sitting on the Mary River system. And that huge volume of water going backwards and forwards every day causes lots and lots of problems. The sort of typical figures that they've published are anywhere between the water level going up and down 2 metres in a day to going up and down 10 metres in a day. And that has a huge problem because that creates an area of bare soil around the rim of the lake, which introduces lots of problems with sediment input. It destroys a lot of habitat or the fringing habitat. And then you've got to remember that that up and down movement area is also then moving up and down seasonally with it. So you could see tens of metres of eroded lake fringe as a result of this project.
And how big an area are we talking about?
The lake fringes are in excess of 45 kilometres of lake fringe currently in Lake Barumba. So if we can find a way to not pump that lower area up and down, we're preserving that 45 kilometres of fringing area. The sort of thing that could happen under the current proposal, that every day you're exposing hundreds of hectares of bare dirt, which is being wet up and drained down every day on the pump cycle, which will produce massive quantities of fine sediment and cause all sorts of downstream problems.
Talk us through the nuts and bolts of what the proposal looks like now and what you would like considered.
So currently the proposal is to have a large storage on the top of the mountain there, so about 70 billion litres of water held in place by half a dozen dam walls, pumping up and down to an enlarged Lake Barumba, and that water pumping backwards and forwards on an almost daily cycle. What we're proposing is we protect Lake Barumba and we protect the rest of the Mary River system from that pump cycle by building what we're calling a balancing storage right adjacent to Yabba Creek on a tributary called Barumba Creek, which is also sitting low in the landscape. And so that creates another smaller storage, which is exclusively for the use of the pumped hydro. So it can be designed to be very efficient from an engineering point, an electrical generation point of view, but it would shelter Lake Barumba itself and the rest of the Mary River from all the adverse effects of the pump cycle.
And what's the difference between that land in both its environmental value and who owns it compared to what they're currently considering?
Where we're proposing is actually in national park and forestry land, but it's all cleared grazing land. It's been managed under a grazing permit up until the current time. So it's actually got very little terrestrial habitat value. And what we're proposing is that if you have that storage there, you won't need the new Barumba Dam to be as big. It could be built at 10 metres lower, which would mean it would keep all the high quality forests and high quality national park that was going to be inundated by the lower storage now doesn't have to be inundated to nearly the same extent. In fact, we think it would keep most of the footprint of the lower dam mostly within the existing water reserve and not impinging much on the national park.
It's hard to get your head around some of the scale of this. Can you talk about just how big this project is?
It's the largest infrastructure project ever attempted in Queensland. That's really saying something. So even the initial estimates is a $14.2 billion project. There's typical blowout on these sort of projects is in excess of 50%. So it's going to end up being more than a $20 billion infrastructure project. So that gives you an idea of the scale of it. Like even the exploratory works, which they still haven't got approval for, but even just the access tunnel, you're building a tunnel the size of a three-lane road that can take heavy earth-moving machinery kilometres under the mountain to 400 metres below ground. So they're huge tunnelling and mining operations. The underground operations of this project are similar in scale to Snowy Hydro 2.
And if you were to do this Barumba Creek balancing storage proposal instead of the upper storage, would that require less tunnelling?
No, it'd just mainly protect the river system from the pump cycle and it'd result in less inundation. It's also a less risky way of doing things because it means the lower dam would be considerably smaller. There's much less risks with the lower dam. We believe it would make the project much less risky during construction and for operation, as well as giving these environmental benefits.
You've talked about the pros. What about the cons?
Well, the cons that come up when we discuss it is there's slightly less elevation distance between the top storage and the proposed lower Barumba storage. So that means from an electrical generation point of view, it's likely to produce slightly less energy. We believe the balancing against that is the fact that because the lower storage is designed specifically just to operate pumped hydro system, it might give them a lot more flexibility in the way they use it. They might be able to have a pump cycle which is much deeper than what they could. Currently, they're constrained by having to look after Lake Barumba in their pump cycle. What we're proposing is if they have a purpose-built lower storage, they can design that as efficiently as they possibly can. So they might lose a little bit in head difference, but they might gain some considerable efficiencies, which might make it even better from an electrical point of view.
That's before them now, and you're just waiting. I suppose the next step is the federal government giving approval for the exploratory works?
Yeah, well, so we've had an undertaking from Queensland Hydro that they are still considering this proposal seriously, and it's being looked at by the design consultants. We understand that they do have to look at it because the terms of reference for the Coordinator General's assessment of it says that they have to look at viable alternatives. So we do believe they are looking at it carefully. We just want the incoming minister and government to look at this carefully, continue looking at this idea.
Steve Burgess from the Mary River Catchment Coordinating Committee speaking to Jennifer Nichols, and a spokesperson for Queensland Hydro says there are dedicated focus groups designed specifically for additional local community input and input from local environmental stakeholders. The project still needs federal government approval of its environmental impact assessment status to proceed. You're listening to the Queensland Country Hour. It's 25 to 1.
During a heatwave, there are things you can do to make yourself more comfortable. Wear lightweight and loose-fitting clothing. Stay indoors out of the heat. Take cool showers and splash yourself with cold water or use a damp cloth. If you don't have air conditioning, go to a shopping centre, community hall, museum or library. For more tips, visit the ABC Emergency website, abc.net.au/emergency.
Now, particularly if you're in the Cape Peninsula, Queensland Health has issued a heat health warning. They're advising of the extreme heatwave conditions that are impacting the Cape Peninsula. They've reached a severity that could pose a risk to parts of the Cape. Low to severe heatwave conditions continue across many parts of the state, and that includes in the far north, northern, northwestern, central and central western parts of Queensland. So you do need to be aware of heatwave conditions in your area. Heat stress can cause a range of health problems, including cramps, exhaustion and heat stroke. You can contact 13 Health, that's 134325, for more information, but always call 000 in an emergency. Queensland Health will issue an update if other health advice changes, and you'll hear about it first here at ABC Radio. Let's check in on the forecast with the Weather Bureau. Shane Kennedy is on duty this afternoon. How are you going, Shane?
Yeah, well, how's it going?
Yeah, very well, thank you. Let's start with the heat conditions. Where are we seeing, I guess, the key heat in Queensland today?
So it's a little bit cooler on Sunday compared to Saturday, but we're still expecting we'll see those hot conditions continue. So it's shifting out of southern Queensland and more into parts of central and northern Queensland at the moment. So still expecting we'll see temperatures 2 to 6 degrees above average in parts of central and northern Queensland, particularly the northwest today. And that heatwave warnings that was cancelled in southern Queensland yesterday, and it likely will be cancelled out of the central highlands with this afternoon's issue that will come out in a couple of hours, but may persist in the central west around Longreach one more day. But after that, should be more focused in the northwest and northern interior, though. Unfortunately, Kelly, you'll likely have that hang around for several more days and probably shift a little bit further into the northeast as well. So we may see the North Tropical Coast and the Herbert and Lower Burdekin districts get included as well, though. They'll stress that doesn't go all the way to the coast. It's more just creeping inland just over the border of those districts. So I'll see that warning appear, but it'll be more for inland parts.
And with those conditions likely to continue for a few days, are we also seeing some instability around storm activity?
Storms should arrive a little bit later, but yeah, you are spot on the money there, Kelly. So expect most of the storm activity will be pretty similar to the weekend. So starting in the Gulf Country around Mount Isa, going down through Longreach into southeastern Queensland, with a focus really to the east of Charleville and a bit further south. And that's due to an inland trough extending over that region. And that trough should shift a little bit further northeast from about Wednesday. And that should move some of those showers and storms a bit more into the northeast interior. So even up into the southern part of Cape York Peninsula. And may get relatively close to the east coast as well. So not quite to the Townsville and Mackay coast, but pretty close. So at least areas inland, including Charters Towers, may see a storm or two from the middle of the week.
Any rainfall with those storms? Anything significant, or are we looking at that sort of lightning and wind risk?
Yeah, it should be more of the latter, Kelly. It should be pretty isolated as well, unfortunately, for the most part. So not expecting too much in the way of significant rainfall, but there is a chance if we get a slow-moving storm, we could see something a bit more significant. And otherwise, just some light showers over the North Tropical Coast and northern Cape York Peninsula for the next day or two. There's just a bit of a tropical wave zipping across the area today and tomorrow, so may see a little bit more cloud and shower activity than over the past few days there, but should be pretty short-lived otherwise. But then looking further ahead for northern Queensland, possibly next weekend with the next trough system, that might make it a bit further east and bring some more substantial rainfall to northern and far northern Queensland.
So, yeah, is that when we might expect some change, maybe a little bit more moisture?
That's right. So we may finally see those temperatures start to break on the weekend with that next system coming across. So it doesn't look too likely for the next several days, unfortunately. Probably still hitting those low 40 degrees inland around Huon and Richmond and parts of the Gulf Country. But looking towards the next weekend, they might finally drop into the high 30s there, and that may help break those heatwave conditions there.
And how are conditions on the coastal waters?
So those are a bit of a mixed bag otherwise, Kelly. Mm. So mostly pretty light in general, just with a light ridge extending over most of the east coast. They're still getting fresh enough up in the northeast, so in that 15 to 20 knot range north of Cooktown in those southeasterlies. And in the south, though, expecting those are freshening up a little bit as it swings more around to the north-northeast, so south of about Hervey Bay, likely to push up into that 15 to 20 knot range over the next couple of days. And that's in association with that pretty active trough in the southeast. So expecting we'll see those showers and storms continue in that broad area, mainly centred around the Darling Downs and Granite Belt, but likely see those severe thunderstorms continuing over the next several days. Will be that potential probably until at least Wednesday and potentially even on to Thursday. We could still see daily severe thunderstorms.
We'll definitely be keeping an eye on those warnings. Shane, thank you very much for your time on the Country Hour today.
Thanks, Kelly. Have a good afternoon.
Shane Kennedy from the Weather Bureau. And yes, keep listening to ABC Radio. We'll head online to abc.net.au/emergency for the warnings in your area. And follow your ABC station on Facebook. You'll get updated information there as well across some of that fire risk, but also the heat risk as that situation develops throughout today. It's just under 22:01.
This is the Country Hour with Kelly Buchanan on ABC Radio Queensland.
Now, as demand for food pricing relief rises from consumers across Australia, the ACCC's inquiry into pricing has heard supermarkets are rejecting fresh vegetables and fruit as farmers deliver produce to retail distribution centres. So this is all part of the Consumer Watchdog's public hearing into supermarket buying behaviour, and it's been told the major retailers have rigid beauty standards for fresh food, and that may not come as much of a shock if you supply them, but consumers are certainly paying attention. Lucy Gregg is from AusVeg, which represents fruit and vegetable growers, and she told inquiry barrister Naomi Sharp that more flexibility would benefit both growers and shoppers.
Yes, I think there is certainly some scope in some areas to reduce the specifications, and I know that they'll say that the consumers want it, and we would argue that consumers are trained to want it. They've been trained to get more and more perfect produce, which looks perfect, and so there are certainly opportunities to I guess have some more flexibility in the specifications without damaging consumer appeal, and certainly without damaging their sensory perceptions and taste and things like that. So, but also sometimes there is flexibility when there's scarcities and things like that to take product which probably doesn't fit the specifications, but because there is not a lot of it, they're quite happy to accept it.
Ms. Gregg, you spoke before about the product going through QC, that's quality control, I assume. So what happens once the vegetables get to the distribution centre? Are they then subject to quality control?
Yes.
And what for? Is every single piece of every item of vegetable checked, or is it random, or how does it work?
There is a sampling rate. I'm not sure what their in-store sampling rate is, but they do obviously check a number of products or bags or whatever across the shipment. Then if they reject it, they will then notify the supplier that the product's been rejected for this reason. Sometimes I know there's some frustration because it seems to be an arbitrary rejection, particularly, as I say, when it gets accepted across four other DCs or it got accepted the day before into the DC and is exactly the same one, but it hasn't been accepted the next day. So, but sometimes, whether it be true or not, sometimes growers say product gets rejected because they've over-ordered. Once again, can't prove that, but that's.
Well, I'll come to ask about that because it's there's been some feedback about that, but it, just in terms of the proposition that there is some arbitrariness with the rejection rate, how significant a concern is this for vegetable suppliers who are your members? Is it a very significant concern? Is it happening a lot, or is this something on the outer bounds?
I would say it's become more of a concern in probably the last 12, 18 months because of such very low margins. And as I say, in some cases, a rejection here, a cancellation there is just the cost of doing business. You just suck it up and move on. But because margins are so low, if not negligible, a rejection of 10, 20, 30, 40, 50,000 of a product in a generic bag that you've got no option but to dump or give to a charity, that's now really starting to hurt. So as I say before, where they probably would have just sucked it up, moved on, now it's actually having a significant impact on their bottom line.
So I appreciate what you've said about the inspections occurring in relation to some sort of sampling plan, but if there's been a shipment of, say, 100 pallets and there's been a decision to reject, is that a per pallet rejection or is it the whole shipment?
It'd be the whole shipment because they've taken a sample and they've deemed the whole shipment, yeah.
And what's the process if a supermarket does decide to reject it? Are you given any opportunity to negotiate with them or understand the basis upon which they've rejected it?
My understanding is that conversations will occur. I'm not sure how much negotiation goes on, but I know conversations do occur. I haven't heard many cases where the supplier's been able to change the mind, but then look, the supplier would either come and collect the product or it would be organised for it to go to a charity.
Lucy Gregg from AusVeg, Australia's peak industry body for vegetables and potatoes, speaking at the ACCC's public hearings into the supermarkets, answering questions there from Senior Counsel Naomi Sharp. And Australia's third largest supermarket, and according to one recent consumer survey, its most trusted, Aldi was questioned at the inquiry today as well. Aldi's Australia Managing Director of National Buying, Jordan Lack, answers questions from Naomi Sharp about the supermarket's presence in regional areas.
Now, Aldi doesn't operate in all states and territories in Australia, does it?
We do not operate in Northern Territory or Tasmania.
And why is that?
It is a deliberate decision on the basis of cost to serve those markets. So we look at the catchment on the size of the market and what would be required to set up operation, and we've made the decision not to enter those markets on the basis of cost.
Aldi did not operate in far north Queensland, but it's right that it has now opened a store in Townsville, isn't it?
I will direct that question to my colleague, Mr. Starr.
Yes, Council, we opened a store in Thurringower, which is in Townsville, earlier this year.
And is Aldi planning to open any further stores in far north Queensland?
Yes, Chair. We're looking at other stores within Townsville. There's an opportunity for more growth in that market and in other areas where we've started growth all up through north Queensland. We opened a store also in Mackay earlier this year, and there's other opportunities along the way up to Townsville.
And it's right that Aldi does not operate in any remote communities?
That's correct, Council.
And why is that?
It's generally back to the position that Mr. Lack said, that it's around the economic viability of stores and the fact that we rely on catchments that are usually a little larger than our competitors. So they're usually typically serviced by smaller supermarkets.
And sorry, what do you mean when you say you typically rely on catchments that are larger than your competitors?
So typically an Aldi store requires a minimum catchment size to make it financially viable, commercially viable. And in a country town, which is where they'd be the smallest, that would generally be in the order of about 15,000. So smaller remote communities are generally much smaller than that and are typically serviced by smaller independent supermarkets.
To what extent does Aldi operate in regional Australia?
So within country New South Wales or Victoria and Queensland, being our largest states, we are very well represented in country areas. In the area I used to be responsible for in Victoria, we're in almost every major town. And that's the case also in New South Wales and Queensland, except for far north Queensland, which has been a more recent decision.
Are there any new geographic areas that, aside from what you've already said, that Aldi is proposing to enter?
Not at this stage, Council.
Andrew Starr is the Managing Director of National Real Estate at Aldi Australia, speaking today at the ACCC's Supermarket Inquiry. You also heard from National Buying Managing Director Jordan Lack and Senior Counsel for the ACCC, Naomi Sharp, and I'll continue to bring you the testimony from that inquiry as it comes to hand, some interesting insights into the decisions that Aldi makes about where it supplies. It's 10 to 1. You're listening to the Queensland Country Hour. And up next, one of those suppliers is calling it quits inside one of Queensland's most iconic fruit families.
You're listening to the Queensland Country Hour with Callie Buchanan on your radio, online and on the ABC Listen app.
Queensland's apple capital is closing the third and final chapter on one iconic family's amazing working life. David and Roz Sutton, who started out as farmers before pivoting to prawn trawling and building one of the state's first cideries, with no experience in either, are selling their famous factory and cafe near Stanthorpe, 3 hours southwest of Brisbane. And here's Brandon Long with their story.
In a factory and cafe nestled in the tiny town of Thalimba, Roz Sutton carefully removes one of her famous apple pies from the hot oven while husband David bottles some fresh cider. It's a familiar scene, but not for much longer. That's because the pair are retiring from their apple careers after 30 years. With their children pursuing their own interests, the duo, now in their mid-70s, has decided to list the business for sale. It'll be a major change for them, but instead of getting teary-eyed, experience has taught them the next adventure is just around the corner. Looking back, David and Roz never expected to be farmers, fishers, and fruit growers. They knew nothing about trawling and had never even seen an apple tree until they bought an orchard. But a devastating setback early in their careers switched their thinking and opened them up to change, making anything seem possible.
Our philosophy's always been, sometimes the less you know, the better, because you've got a new view of how you may be able to do something.
This philosophy, coupled with the drive to provide for their three children, gave the husband and wife team a positive attitude in the face of adversity. Whether it was floods and drought, late nights and rough seas, or supermarkets and pandemics, they knew they could face it together. Now the name Sutton is synonymous with apples around the fruit's Queensland capital of Stanthorpe. David and Roz's amazing story began in the small northwest New South Wales town of Yetman, 50 minutes southeast of Gundawindi. Her father was a livestock agent who leased property and ran cattle and sheep, and Farmer Dave, as he became known, was brought up on a 1,200-hectare mixed farm. After getting married, they were prepared to stay at David's family farm indefinitely, but it wasn't meant to be. In 1976, one of the state's worst floods ripped through the property.
It actually destroyed this nice 200-acre Well, we had 3,000 acres, but we had 200 acres of beautiful river country that we had irrigated with the first travelling irrigators. We were doubling cropping, and it was highly successful. And after the flood had been through, the crop, the grain sorghum crop was just stripped off it. The nice topsoil was taken, and all that was left was gravel and big gutters that you couldn't actually even drive a tractor over. So we went into other things then to survive, like what dealing in cattle was and share farming grain and contract harvesting. And it was then that we decided, OK, we're going to take a total change, do something else, because we're never going to be able to use that farm the way it was. And we just happened to choose prawn trawling.
They bought a trawler and settled in steamy Lucinda, 2 hours north of Townsville. Applying their strong work ethic to the new venture began to pay off, and it was then that they realised they'd made the right move.
It was very, very lucrative to us, but we really worked at it because we'd come from the background where it was grain growing, whatever, leasing land, and you really had to work at it to make very little. And it really is the trawler. We were making more money in the months than we ever turned over on the farm in a year.
After 14 years of breathing in the sea breeze, it was time for another change. So the couple and their children packed up and headed to the state's coldest region, the Granite Belt, in 1994. They bought a working orchard with apple and stone fruit trees and got to work, initially selling to supermarkets.
And we knew nothing about those, so we just jumped in, boots and all, and off we went.
We were forced to change because of the supermarkets becoming very picky about the apples they wanted in size, shape, colour, etc., etc. And realistically, we had two farms at that stage, but we made a decision to change, and we grew berries, raspberries and blackberries for a while. And once the children are educated, we actually moved on again to the value adding.
They soon removed all the commercial apple trees and replaced them with smaller cider varietals, built one of Queensland's first commercial cideries, and they started sourcing food apples from a local grower to make juice and apple cider vinegar. The next logical step was to open a cafe. Everything was going steady until 2019, when COVID-19 started spreading. But rather than put the brakes on and lay off staff, they approached it the only way they knew how.
Well, particularly through COVID, we tended to go with the flow. And even though there was doom and gloom about what would and wouldn't happen, so we just kept processing and kept building up stock. We kept our staff on, we didn't change anything. And so, of course, when the first restrictions were lifted, there were just so many people came to get out of Brisbane, to come over the range. It was quite amazing.
After restrictions lifted, they had 14,000 people through the doors in the first 20 days. Roz had to take on the cooking, and David took on the processing.
We certainly worked some very long days to accommodate all those people who came to enjoy what the fruits of our labour, I guess. Mm-hmm. So that was challenging times, but incredibly rewarding, and we worked together to make that work.
David remembered the rush with a twinkle in his eye.
After that, it really started to get busy, to be honest. It just blew up, just took off. And that was pretty satisfying, very satisfying.
From then on, the business has never been busier. Sutton's now uses about 100 tonnes of apples a year, enough to make 20,000 kilograms of pie filling, 80,000 bottles of juice and 10,000 bottles of cider. Whether the new owners keep the Sutton name on the factory or choose their own is completely up to them. David and Roz just hope they enjoy the adventure as much as they have.
I've made literally thousands and thousands of apple pies. These days I have handed it over to some very capable people who work for us. Oh, it's absolutely crazy, but look, it's wonderful, and it's wonderful in this day and age to be producing products made from the apple, focusing on the apple and some other local products as well. And we've stayed true to that. I remember when we opened a cafe, people said, oh, well, you have to have Coke and soft drink. And I went, no, you can just have apple juice and apple juice and apple juice.
Roz and David Sutton, owners of Sutton's Farm, ending that story from Brandon Long, reflecting on decades in agriculture in Queensland. That's it for the Queensland Country Hour today. I'm Callie Buchanan. Thanks for your company this afternoon. It's time for you to get the latest in news now at 1 o'clock.